very much, David, and thank you, all of you, for coming. Slight disclaimer in that my book on Charlemagne was published 2008, and I've always got this feeling I want to say something that isn't already in print, but I haven't achieved that, I don't think, tonight, but I put it in, packaged it rather differently, and was prompted by the fact that I asked you to read Einhard. How many of you actually managed it? Oh, virtue. Right. That's fine. What I've tried to do is also give you an idea of the kind of evidence that one uses to construct knowledge about Charlemagne, and to help, I've put a facsimile of one of his finest books, which was produced in his court school, given to a nearby monastery at the back, so you can see the size, the weight, and the appearance. And do feel free to turn the pages, and the covers survive, though they're divided between the Vatican and the V&A. Now, why did I ask you to read Einhard? Those of you who haven't managed, don't worry, because I'm going to tell you what's in it. Now, I asked you to read it for three reasons. First of all, because it was the form in which many, since Charlemagne's death, 28th of January, 814, almost 1,200 years ago, gained knowledge of the king and his rule. The second reason to start with him is, although it is only one example of the wealth of 8th and 9th century evidence, contemporary and near contemporary, relating to Charlemagne, it is also perhaps the most tendentious. And thirdly, there is a reason why it is such an influential text as a piece of historical writing, and its structure and content have provided a template for nearly every subsequent attempt at biography or documentation of his reign. I want, first of all, to say a little bit about Einhard's Vita Karoli, Life of Charles itself, before I move on to give you a summary of Charlemagne's achievement and explore some of its particularities in more detail, especially relating to culture and learning. Comment, first of all, on the text dissemination and the promotion of knowledge about Charlemagne throughout. This is pale brown ink, but it is an inadequate version on my iPhone because I discovered I didn't have a picture of it. There are 123 manuscripts of Einhard's Vita Karoli extant, which is very good for a medieval text, and they range from the 9th century through to the 15th. None of them, however, can be described as an autograph, and the earliest manuscripts post-date the composition of the text by at least two generations. So the one you see here is late 10th or early 11th century. Now, it is referred to by a scholar called Lupus of Ferrières, saying that he's actually seen it. And also, it was supplied with a preface by Wolfred Strabo, that's my heart's pardon, Wolfred Strabo at the bottom there, who had attested to his reputation, and he was the one that introduced the chapter titles. And all our excellent manuscripts have those, so we're working from the version that Wolfred produced. Printed editions were produced from the 15th century onwards, most usually from whichever manuscript was most handy to use for the printer concerned. In the 20th century alone, there were 13 different editions of the Latin text and 8 different English translations, let alone those into French, Italian, German, Polish, Spanish, and Danish. An indigestible 1,828-page German doctoral thesis, or PhD students here, please do not do that, published in 2001, painstakingly documents the transmission of Einhard manuscripts. The seat's down the front, much more comfortable for you. Transmission of Einhard manuscripts in England, Flanders, France, Italy, and southern Germany, as well as printed editions. So, a much produced text. I think we can assume a much read text, though we might want to discuss that later. Now, the Vita Karoli has proved to be the most seductive and influential of the representations of Charlemagne ever written. As you see, he states in his preface that the Vita Karoli was composed in order to celebrate the king's life, his way of life, vita et conversatio, his many accomplishments, his deeds, and his habits. Einhard was moved to write the life of the most splendid and greatest of all men out of gratitude to the king he regarded as his nutritor, nourishing him. He risked criticism for his inadequacies, but this was to be further than to neglect the memory of one so great. And like many writers, this is actually modesty topos. He wrote very, very good Latin. Einhard stressed, and this is really the important part, his personal knowledge of the subject, and we can corroborate that from other sources. But he acknowledged its limits in that he knew too little about the king's early life to write about it. Now, although this text is so well known, it may be helpful to repeat its principal topics. Einhard offers a brief account of how Charlemagne's father Pippin took the throne of Francia from the feeble Merovingians, whose last long-haired king was reduced to one estate and travelling around in an ox cart. He then provides a summary of Charlemagne's conquests, which is rounded out with an ethnogeographical account of the Carolingian Empire. He adds a description of the building work at Aachen, Mainz, Ingelheim and Nijmegen that Charlemagne undertook to improve and beautify the kingdom. Einhard is not only concerned with Charlemagne as mighty conqueror, however, he also offers a sketch of Charlemagne's character, his family life, his religious devotion and friendship with the Pope. Einhard reports that the king knew Latin and Greek, had an interest in learning, his favourite reading was allegedly Augustine's City of God, and that he summoned scholars to him to serve as his teachers. The description of the king's slightly odd appearance is famous. He was very tall, at the beginnings of a paunch, a small head, and a surprisingly high voice for somebody so big. He loved swimming in the hot springs at Aachen, preferred to wear straightforward Frankish clothes, not sissy Roman ones, slept fitfully at night, and was fond of eating red meat. Even within the household, he gave his attention to ruling and administration of justice. Some references made to the king's attention to law and to the creation of the grammar of his mother tongue, as well as to the ruler's piety and devotion to St. Peter and Rome. The final section of the life deals with the arrangements for the succession, Charlemagne's last illness, portents of his death and full details of his will, his death and burial. Einhard himself clearly exploited other written information and narrative sources, such as a history known as the Royal Frankish Annals, to compile his account. And these annals and their continuations, written in a notoriously triumphalist manner, or as close as one can get to an official history of the Franks in the reign of Charlemagne, his sons and grandsons, promoted by people within the court circle. Einhard echoes the emphasis of the final sections of the Royal Frankish Annals in his use of embassies and gifts Charlemagne received from other rulers in the far west, the south and the east, from Ireland, the Asturias in Spain, the Persians in Byzantium, to symbolise the king's power. But Einhard also draws, as I said earlier, on his own memory of what he had seen or what he had been told. And those for whom he wrote would have had their own memories. One needs to think about that when one's reading the text. The relationship between his own account and existing historical narrative and memories raises the crucial question, therefore, of how the text might have functioned and how it was intended initially to function. What kind of historical text was it if it was possibly never intended to serve as a comprehensive biography in the sense that we might understand that? Einhard's inspiration from classical texts, far beyond emulating their Latin style, which he did do, is well known. It is clear that he also followed the ideal form of history implied at various points by Cicero, the classical author, in his Orator and De Oratore. Chronological arrangement, geographical precision, clear narrative of doings and sayings, exhibitions of causes and consequences, biographical details about the character's life, and a notion of what the author himself approved. Cicero himself was master of the rhetorical traditions of the praise of famous men, panegyric and laudationes, which the Greek rhetor Menander had outlined as ideal topics to be addressed, and these were subsequently adapted by such Roman rhetors as Quintilian. Cicero. So you see some of them there, fatherland and so forth, with the suitable topics, therefore, that you might bring to the task. And Einhard actually invokes the particular topic Cicero recommends, there's a seat down the front, for the panegyricist in his preface, namely the deeds, the factor, and the achievements of the res gesta, and that's a direct echo of Cicero. Now, these are inspirations from texts, but one also has to think about visual representations of Roman imperial power and achievements available at the time. Because just as the Round Church in Cambridge or most of the colleges here will give you buildings as part of your normal landscape, but which are 500-600 years old, so for the Franks, the Roman world was all around them physically. Also, Einhard had visited Rome. He went there as papal embassy in 806. He would have seen Trajan's column and the way those deeds would have been elaborated. Einhard's indebtedness to Suetonius's Lives of the Twelve Caesars, and especially the Lives of Augustus, Nero, and Caligula, however, has, thanks to Isaac Coelebon, a 16th century scholar, long been recognised. These were not only verbal echoes, but also direct borrowings in the discussion of the clothes, family, personal devotion to learning, linguistic abilities and religious faith, omens and portents before death, last illness and death, and the will, even to the liking of a nap after lunch. Now, therefore, it's not just that he's following the idea of writing biography, he's actually emulating particular examples from antiquity to do it. And Suetonius was not the only Roman historian Einhard knew or had read in entirety or in extracts and quotations. There is also a striking resemblance between the structure and topics covered in the Vita Karoli, and this is something new before, and those of the various lives in the notorious 4th century concoction of lives of the Roman emperors, known as Suetores Historiae Augusta. Classicists hate this text, but it's full of really fantastic stories in both senses of the word. Notably, the life of Hadrian, the spoof author Aelius Spartianus, crammed it with information and incidents. The life starts out with an account, and listen carefully because you hear the same kinds of themes of the original home and details about members of the family. It recounts Hadrian's birth, his devotion to study, military service, how he became too fond of hunting, and then aspects of his career, maintenance of his legitimacy, he appoints his heir. Maintaining peace involved a lot of war making, and it describes all of that. It describes also the domestic plots against him, special attention to justice, administration of property, many public building works, especially in Rome. And then reforms of the army, his interest in learning, poetry, literature, arithmetic, geometry, painting, flute playing and singing, his debates with professors and philosophers, his love for the writings of particular writers, and his patronage of scholars and the arts. Now, this chaotic biography of Hadrian concludes with his arrangement for his successor, his death, and his burial. Now, the role of the Scriptores Historiae Augustae, then, is far greater than that of a supplier of arcane vocabulary, as it once has been acknowledged as supplying one word for Einhard. It appears to have acted as another source of ideas, topics, and structure for the presentation of the life of the emperor. And there is manuscript corroboration that Einhard could have known, actually, the earliest surviving text that we now have of the Scriptores. But another initial source of inspiration for the composition of the life of Charlemagne is the Agricola of Tacitus. And again, it's verbal echoes that have prevented people from appreciating how important these connections are. It offers much stronger parallels in form and intention even than Suetonius. And what Tacitus offered became the standard structure of secular biography on which Suetonius and then Einhard drew, as a political and military leader, as well as demonstration in a sort of post-mortem prose panegyric. Now, I've actually made a detailed case for that connection elsewhere in my book, so I won't go into detail now. But the point about it for now is that it was a funerary panegyric. And I maintain that if the context of Einhard's life is to be understood, then the parallel with Tacitus is quite important, because it extends to its function now and its date. Now, the date of Einhard is much disputed. It's usually dated between 823 and 829, and you'll find any date offered between 814 and 829. So I've stuck my neck out and got into a lot of trouble with various scholars by suggesting it was written between 814 and 817 as a panegyric, a funerary panegyric after the death. And it's Tacitus that actually enables us to do that. The sheer power of the text and the degree to which it might have functioned effectively as a funerary oration, panegyric, and celebration of the king soon after his death does, I think, need to be acknowledged. And it helps to explain a lot of the emphases in the text. I'll return to that right at the end of my talk. Let me now then consider, we've pieced together some of Charlemagne's reign from Einhard, but let's add to it now the material that you can gain use to gain other aspects of his reign and how you piece it all together. A map is always a good idea at this point. When Charlemagne's father, Pippin III, usurped the Frankish throne in 751, he was then the prime minister, and deposed the last Merovingian king, he came into possession of a Christian and Catholic kingdom, it's the purple bit on the map, that was the most successful of Rome's heirs among the barbarian successor states of the Roman Empire, with many Roman administrative and documentary practices retained. Now, that's not quite right, because Pippin had to get control over all this southern bit. So it's there, that's Pippin's part. But when he died in 768, was the purple part. And he handed on his newly won kingdom to his two sons, Charles and Carloman, and the Frankish realm then occupied the whole of the former Roman provinces of Gallia, Germania, and Belgica. Under Charlemagne, the sole ruler of the Franks after his brother's death in 771, the kingdom expanded to embrace most of what we now call Western Europe, as you can see, because all the pale blue bits that were added by Charlemagne. Now, the first major acquisition of his reign was the kingdom of the Lombards in northern Italy, in answering an appeal for help from the papacy. Charlemagne was able to capture the royal city of Pavia after a short siege and be accepted as the Lombards' ruler without much further bloodshed in the winter of 773 to 774. In 788, he annexed Bavaria, the realm of his cousin Tassilo. After a show trial of Tassilo, in which charges of oath-breaking were levelled at him, his duchy was taken away from him, and he and his family were incarcerated in various different West Frankish monasteries far from their own homeland. Campaigns were conducted by Charlemagne and his armies with the successful creation of two marches in eastern Brittany by 799, and in the far south of Gaul and northwest Spain, a region known as Septimania, between 797 and 803. Frankish military expeditions were mounted against the Avars in the late 780s, so right over in this area here. And these culminated in the defeat and capturing of the famous Avar ring and its fabulous treasure, of which this is an example of Avar treasure, but not necessarily an example of the Avar treasure that Charlemagne captured, but it's the right kind of date, it's now in Vienna. With hindsight, the only intended Frankish conquest appears to have been the protracted series of campaigns over more than three decades against the Saxons. Summer after summer, from 772 until 803, the military host was assembled and led against the peoples of Westphalia and then of the regions beyond the Weser and Elbe rivers. And it's a rather schematic map. All you can really see is the yellow blobs. But if you think of the Elbe River downwards towards France, the yellow bits are the bits where he was conducting campaigns over those 30 years. With the establishment of Carolingian rule over the vast area east of the Rhine and north of the Danube, the limits of the Carolingian Empire were defined, and the end of expansion appears to have been a conscious decision. The diplomacy conducted with the peoples beyond his borders suggests that Charlemagne at least, and to some degree his successors, perceived these limits themselves rather than their being imposed by the greater strength for some of the peoples on the periphery. And it's a bit of a puzzle that needs to be thought about. Certainly it is in terms of the territory created by Charlemagne that the inheritance and succession of subsequent kings is discussed. Another seat right down the front, both of us. These kings, moreover, had to be legitimate adult male members of the Carolingian family. In 806, for example, Charlemagne himself made provision for the division of his realm between three of his sons, Charles the Younger, Pippin of Italy, and Louis the Pious. Gibbon complained bitterly that all the Carolingian rulers were called Charles, Pippin, or Louis. It was very confusing. In which Charles was to inherit the greater part, including Saxony, while Pippin was to receive Italy and Bavaria, and Louis was to retain the sub-kingdom of Aquitaine. Because Charles and Pippin predeceased their father, all these plans came to naught, and Louis alone, known as Louis the Pious, succeeded to the kingship and the empire on his father's death in 814. So how did they rule this lot? Charlemagne and his heirs maintained a political system that accommodated diversity and a plurality of political and religious centres across the huge extent of his territories. He developed aspects of the administration already in the process of formation under his father Pippin, as well as making many innovations of his own. Thus, he devoted a remarkable degree of effort into ensuring a strong communications network between the various centres and their hinterlands, in which written documents, letters, charters and capitularies played an essential role in addition to the oral role of the assemblies and the royal officials. The assemblies convened each year, there's a representation of it here from a book produced in the 820s, were a prominent aspect of the royal topography of power, not least because they were attended by learned ecclesiastical magnates from across the entire realm. And letters were sent out saying where they were going to be, and everyone was supposed to come with very strict instructions as to what to bring and how to support themselves. And what one has to imagine is people coming from far and wide, travelling through the inns, a very, very visible aspect of rule going to the assemblies. They were obviously a means for the king to be informed about the affairs of the kingdom, but there were also occasions to hear and decide upon legal disputes, receive ambassadors, determine new economic and administrative arrangements, and how ecclesiastical concerns were to be addressed. And I've given you an example here from the Frankfurt Council of 794. Among a host of other matters, small and great, the assembly stated its position on iconoclasm, coming from Byzantium, there had been a statement about it, doctrine and adoptionism, I don't think you want to know about that, heard Tassilo of Bavaria's final renunciation of all his and his family's rights and properties, regulated the prices, weights and measures to be used across the entire realm, announced the reform of the coinage to be used in every city and every market bearing the imprint of our name of silver and full weight, pronounced on the administration of justice, especially in the bishop's courts, forbade secular plots and coniuratios or conspiracies, settled a dispute about the ecclesiastical jurisdiction of the archbishops of Ars and Vienne, discussed discipline in monasteries and the fate of orphaned girls, prescribed the creation of popular saints, and announced that papal permission had been granted for Angerand, Archbishop of Sens, and Hildebold, Archbishop of Cologne, to be absent from their sees in order to serve the king permanently in his palace as head of his writing office and his palace chapel, respectively. In 802, the Assembly at Aachen, among other matters, made major reforms of the system of missi dominici, or royal agents, insisted on the proper administration of justice, and required the re-administration of the oath of fidelity to the king from all freemen now that he had been made emperor. And I haven't actually said very much about that, and I'm actually not going to, but we can talk about it afterwards if you want. Legates were received from the Arabic rulers of Spain, the ruler of Persia, the Avars, Danish kings, Venice, Dalmatia and Croatia, Jerusalem, Northumbria, Byzantium and Rome at many of these assemblies, both during Charlemagne's reign and in those of his successor. And the decrees from these assemblies, known as capitularies, the reports of the embassies, as well as of events beyond the empire recorded in the assembly proceedings and annal narratives, create an imperial landscape with the ruler at the centre of affairs and the stability of what is now an empire, he was crowned on Christmas Day 800 in Rome by the Pope, as a whole contrasting with events on the outer rim of the territory under Frankish control. Charlemagne's officials conducted royal business on his behalf throughout his empire. Towards the end of his reign, he becomes increasingly sedentary, apart from hunting trips. The creation of this vast realm, stretching from the Atlantic Ocean and North Sea to the Mediterranean and Baltic Seas, and encompassing many of the greatest river systems in Europe, including the Rhine, the upper reaches of the Danube, the Weser and the Elbe, incorporated many new peoples and imposed challenges for order and control, quite apart from those of cohesion, identity, and a sense of belonging. Such order and control depended far more on an extended administrative network, local officials, peripatetic royal agents, and insistence on the maintenance of justice than on force and military presence. Nevertheless, the role of the army in the maintenance of this early medieval empire needs to be considered in the light of an absence of a standing army organized by the state. Instead, there was a system of organized military service with villages, estates, and their lords sending military contingents when summoned to do so by the ruler. So for Saxony, it was every year. Yet all these military campaigns were effectively concluded by about 800, and thereafter it does seem to be an empire geared to peace. And one form of evidence in which this can be documented is in the evidence of defensive structures. There are hardly any. There appears to be general agreement that defensive structures and repair of old Roman fortifications really aren't happening before the end of the 9th century. And the few known before that, such as the Danevirk at the base of the Jutland Peninsula, right on the peripheries of the Carolingian Empire, and in any case, the Danevirk was built by the Danes and not by the Franks. Conversely, the Carolingians constructed large palace complexes with rich materials and expert workmanship at Aachen, Compiègne, Frankfurt, Ingelheim, Nijmegen, Paderborn, Regensburg, Worms, and many more. These included spaces for ceremonial display, as well as for religious worship and living quarters. Aachen was built on the site of a Roman bath complex, hence the hot springs in which he splashed happily with his courtiers, according to Einhard, and incorporated an aula, residential buildings, and a glorious chapel, as you see here, ornamented with marble columns, mosaics, elaborate bronze screens, and monumental bronze doors. At Ingelheim, there was a very wide semicircular building and an aula that's being reconstructed in this particular illustration. And there are others that have been excavated, which shows similarly aula, rich materials, but the point is, most of these palaces, if not all of them, were unfortified. This is no sign of fortifications. These palaces were built and decorated with deliberate evocations of the imperial past, not least spolia from Roman buildings. An Aachen chapel, for instance, is usually understood to have been inspired by Justinian's church of San Vitale at Ravenna. You see another representation on the left from the 13th century reliquary, and on the right, a black and white picture of the interior with its columns. The royal aula at Ingelheim, the one I showed you the reconstruction of, was decorated with a series of royal portraits from Ninus of the Assyrians, Phalaris of Sicily, and Cyrus of the Persians to the Roman emperors Augustus, or Constantine and Theodosius, as well as the Frankish rulers Charles Martel, Pippin III, and Charlemagne himself. Let me turn now to culture and learning. Charlemagne's promotion of correct thinking, orthodoxy, and correct language, summed up in the Latin term correctio, is an essential component of his overall exercise of power within the Carolingian Empire. The Christian faith and the Latin language were together the key elements of Carolingian culture and learning. Charlemagne's capitulary legislation, an abundance of letters, poems, and treatises, and the manuscript books associated with him all attest to the remarkable concentration on ways to achieve correctio and enhance knowledge within his realm. The texts produced include many didactic and pedagogic tracts on grammar and spelling, an abundance of letters and celebratory poetry, commentaries on various books of the Bible, sophisticated theological and philosophical discussions, and encyclopedias. Not the least of these was an encyclopedia of time, which you see here, produced within court circles in the 780s and then augmented in the 809. Religious devotion was a crucial element in Charlemagne's conception of his role as ruler within his realm. Charlemagne's visit to particular saints' burial places to honour their cults and the regular record of where he spent Easter and Christmas are striking features of the contemporary analyst's account of his reign, its real punctuation of his movements. They frame them within Christian time in such a way as to emphasise how major political occasions and royal demonstrations of power, from his coronation in 768 and the Feast of Saint Denis onwards, were orchestrated within an essentially liturgical framework. Education, moreover, was perceived by both the king and his advisers as the essential means to ensure that both the Christian faith and the Latin language were maintained. The Admonitio Generalis of 789, you see the earliest manuscript of it on the right, concluded the commands, the one on the left, that schools be established for teaching boys the Psalms, the Notae, nobody's decided what that means yet, singing, computation, and grammar. Correct and accurate copies were to be made of the Catholic books. This recognition of the link between language and faith, and between the state of learning and the stability of Orthodox Christian belief, was a crucial element of what has become known as the Carolingian Renaissance, or Renovatio, alongside correctio, renovatio, is a prominent aspect of Charlemagne's reign. This stress on the Latin language, as well as the Christian faith, may come as something of a surprise. But it is important to remember that most of the region over which Charlemagne ruled had once been part of the Roman Empire. Latin had been the language of communication, at least in all the written documents that survive from the Frankish kingdoms since the 5th century. In the area we now think of as France, Latin at the end of the 8th century had only just begun its development from Romance to French. And in the lands east of the Rhine, the native language was German in a number of dialects. But the earliest appearance of written German towards the end of the late 8th century appears to have been a pedagogic device to assist the process of conversion. The first texts we have are the Lord's Prayer and catechisms. In addition, whatever anyone may have spoken in private or in domestic contexts, all public communication, whether related to law and justice, religion, government or education, was conducted in Latin. Thus, Latin was indeed a lingua franca across the entire Carolingian Empire. And it is because Latin is so vital as a means of contemporary communication and government that correct Latin was promoted so thoroughly in the Carolingian realms. Consequently, every Latin manuscript that we have from this period is a particular example both of the transmission and consolidation of the extraordinary cultural inheritance of the Franks and of the special expertise cultivated by Charlemagne and all who worked for him to make the fullest use of that inheritance. Now, Einhard gives us some interesting comments on the king's own knowledge of languages, and he explains that the king, that's actually an instance of trying to learn some grammar from Festus, but here's Einhard's text, that he learned Latin so well that he could speak it as well as he could his own language, and the supposition is that he spoke a Rhine Franconian dialect. But he could understand Greek better than he could speak it. He also commanded that the native and very old songs in which the deeds and wars of the old kings were sung be written down for posterity, and himself began a grammar of his paternal tongue. He even created words for the months and 12 winds in his own language, and Einhard does include those. And we have other instances of attempts to learn German from glossaries, and this is the Abrigans glossary from St. Gallen. Now, Carolingian Latin was deliberately corrected in both its orthography and grammar from how it had developed by the end of the 8th century to conform more strictly with older classical and Ciceronian standards. So you get a division gradually developed between spoken Latin on the one hand, which turns into French, and written Latin, which remains very formal and very classical. Yet a reversion to older standards was not the only aim, if you think about it. The creation of a degree of conformity was probably necessary among the different Latin traditions and even pronunciation and accents among both the scholars at the court and in the Carolingian realm more widely. Think of any room in Cambridge where you hear a diversity of English accents, and some of them are clearer than others. Think of it then in Latin. Thus, the symbolic and historic force of Latin was enhanced at the highest level and became an essential means of communication. Such a political promotion of Latin and literacy in an empire in which Roman and Germanic languages were current had a profound impact on the total sense of cultural identity. Further, Latin provided the means for the Franks to associate themselves with the Roman, biblical and Christian past in the most fundamental way possible, because they therefore had access to all the texts that they needed. The promotion of Latin literacy meant that the Latin texts of antiquity and of the early Christian church became part of the Frankish cultural inheritance. Charlemagne himself contributed to the identification and promotion of the most crucial methods as well as texts to expedite this process. So it's in that context that Carolingian education, book production, and the promotion of the liberal arts needs to be understood. In his 786 letter to the lectores, he says, "We have summoned whom we can, even by our own example, to master the studies of the liberal arts." And in a letter sent to all the monasteries and bishoprics in his kingdom, which survives in this very, very faint, it's not a bad photograph, it's just a very faint manuscript, now in the Bodleian, he sent a letter, it's the only copy surviving, apparently sent it to everybody. All were exhorted that they should devote their efforts to the study of literature and to the teaching of it, each according to his ability, let men be chosen for the task of improving knowledge, who have the will and ability to learn, and also the desire to instruct others. Whence came Charlemagne's conviction of the importance of education, book production, and religion in relation to royal rulership? Einhard offered no information about the king's own early education, didn't know about it, but Pippin III, Charlemagne's father, had been educated at the monastery of Saint-Denis near Paris as a boy. Charlemagne, as a king's son, certainly from the age of three, is more likely to have been educated at the royal court, perhaps among young scholars said to have gathered around his mother, Queen Bertrada. Einhard also records that Charlemagne not only encouraged the liberal arts generally, but that he thought his children ought to be educated. In the first place, they should be trained in the liberal arts, and the liberal arts means grammar, rhetoric, dialectic, music, geometry, astronomy, and arithmetic. And that remains the basis of medieval education in the medieval universities right up to the Reformation, and actually beyond it in many instances. In addition, his sons were to be taught riding, military skills, and hunting, and his daughters weaving and spinning. Further, Charlemagne gathered scholars at court. I mentioned that earlier, but indeed he did, to extend his own knowledge. The earliest evidence for his interest in the learning and the cultural activity we associate with the court is the 770s and 780s. So that where the court was might not always have been Aachen, as people used to think, but probably settled around a number of these palaces and also at some of the major royal monasteries, such as Saint-Denis or Corbie or Lorsch. And it's possible perhaps that scholars would gather in the winter at the royal court. The baths, of course, would be an attraction wherever the king was, so not necessarily a permanent community, in other words. Again, it is Einhard who says that Charlemagne studied grammar with the deacon Peter of Pisa, and that for rhetoric, dialectic, and astronomy, from books like this, Nine Erratus, he had as his teacher the Englishman Alcuin of York. Alcuin himself, moreover, indicates in a letter dated 796 that the royal palace had become a place where young men generally could study wisdom. And Theodulf of Orléans, a person with whom Alcuin was always quarrelling, wrote a poem on the court designed to be circulated and read at court before being recited publicly, and again praises Charlemagne's skill and judgment, his wife's learning, and the learning of many court members by name. So these scraps of evidence indicate that from Pippin III's accession onwards, the Carolingians had some kind of group of scholars at court for some of the year, and that instruction, while more in the form of discussions than a formal school, would focus on the seven liberal arts, that is, grammar, rhetoric, dialectic, music, geometry, and arithmetic. And another instance of the kind of book that might have been used is this book written at the royal court, though probably in Louis the Pious's reign, of the Agrimensores, the book on surveying. What they also, of course, studied was the Bible and theology. And Charlemagne actively encouraged education and learning in the kingdom at large, not just at court, as we saw from the De Litteris Calendis. So what we have in Einhard, corroborated by a great deal of other evidence, is an image of an intelligent king with sophisticated intellectual interests, who even listened during his main meal of the day to some recitation or reading, rather like a monk, and who delighted in the books of St. Augustine, especially the City of God. More controversial is Einhard's claim about Charlemagne's scribal skills. Could he write or couldn't he? And he describes how he used to put the pen under his pillow when he couldn't sleep to try and write, and it's perplexed many. It still perplexes many. One possible explanation might be that he is trying to write Caroline Minuscule. I can't actually see that very well, but it's the formal script that developed in the later 8th century, very, very formal in contrast to the kind of thing notaries would have written, and that's what he found difficult. But even Einhard acknowledges that Charlemagne commanded that the unwritten laws of all people under his authority should be written down, and claims that he corrected most diligently the manner of reading and singing psalms. He was highly accomplished in both, though never read publicly and only in a low voice, along with everyone else. And it's further indicative of his intellectual and learned interest in language and the Bible that he was assiduous in his attendance at palace chapel services. And again, it's not just Einhard who tells us about that. We get indirect evidence for his own education in that we witnessed the outcome of his interest rather than being able to document exactly how he acquired it. And as a ruler, of course, he had notaries and secretaries who would act as his scribes and write charters for him like this one. But there basically seems to be little doubt concerning his linguistic skills, his reading ability at least, and his intellectual strengths. We've actually got a book surviving that was written at the court about images, and the comments in the margin have been attributed to Charlemagne, and they say things like, oh, good point, or yes, very, very acute, or excellent. Now, fortunately, books survive which both witness to Charlemagne's intellectual interests in religious devotion and Christian observance. And given the strong Christian emphasis there is in Carolingian education and learning, intellectual and religious preoccupations are, of course, intertwined. An obvious instance is the way Charlemagne promoted the provision of correct liturgical texts for use in his chapel and in the kingdom at large, as well as texts of the Bible, with scholarship directed towards the production of an accurate version of the key texts for the Christian rituals. And the gospel book at the back is actually the court edition of those gospels. And you need to know that the text of the Vulgate wasn't actually finally sorted out until the early 16th century, but the Carolingians made many efforts towards that. One by Théodore Orléans in a very, very fine copy, proper edition with consultation possibly even of the Hebrew, and the other by his great rival Alcuin in the Bibles that were produced from Tours. Now here it's perhaps best to distinguish the provision of books used in the liturgy on the one hand, and books relating to secular and Christian knowledge on the other. So I'm just going to say a few words about both categories and give you some illustrations. Now, the Carolingian world was one in which the power of prayer acted alongside worldly demonstrations of authority and physical strength. It makes no sense in this period to talk about church and state as separate entities. Charlemagne's religious observance is strongly confirmed by his royal diplomas and the clauses that affirm his pious intentions and religious justification for support of his church. And he played a fundamental role in establishing a network of bishoprics, monasteries and the like in his own kingdom and as he conquered new regions. So lots and lots of new bishoprics established in Saxony, new monasteries supported. And that meant cash being put into them to make them. And his effort was described by Theodore of Orléans in 812. For this is always dear to him, to exercise bishops on the search of the Holy Scriptures and prudent and sound doctrine, every cleric in discipline, philosophers in the knowledge of things divine and human, monks in religion and in sanctity, primates in council, judges in justice, soldiers in practice of aim, prelates in humility, subjects in obedience, all generally in prudence, justice, fortitude, temperance, and concord. And his personal devotion to prayer is indicated in the Godescalc Gospels, of which you see a fountain of life, written actually mostly in gold on purple dyed parchment, a celebratory book with a baptismal theme, hence the fountain of life in this picture, associated with Charlemagne's visit to Rome in 781, and the baptism of his young son Pippin, who subsequently became king of Italy. And this is thought to be a representation of the Lateran baptistry where Pippin was baptized. Astonishingly enough, the book was used as a gift from the city of Toulouse to mark the baptism and coronation of Napoleon Bonaparte's son, the king of Rome, in 1811. And that's how it came to the Bibliothèque Nationale. It was commissioned by Charlemagne and his wife Hildegard, and contains extracts from the Gospels to be read throughout the Christian year. And the work of Godescalc is identified in it by name in the book. And he's a member of what's known as the Hofschule group. And another member was Dagulf, who produced the Dagulf Psalter, another book, mostly gold on purple, originally designed as a gift for Pope Hadrian, still in its original ivory covers, very, very beautifully carved. And it includes the Psalms, a collection of creeds and creed commentaries, and there's a selection of the biblical canticles, including the Magnificat and Nunc Dimittis, and it is actually in the Carolingian period that Mag and Nunc, as the choir rudely called them, became established as essential parts of the evening liturgy, and really a standard element. Now, the Dagulf's sort of set of canticles is actually echoed then in subsequent Carolingian manuscripts. These more private books are complemented by books sent to or commissioned by Charlemagne in order to provide the key text. And he says, I want a a new edition. He gets a new edition produced, and then he gets copies made of it, and then he sends everybody the copies, saying this is what you now have to use. And it's not just gospel books, he also does canon law, the Rule of St. Benedict, he tries to get in the original version, the sacramentary, which he procured from Rome, and also the collection of homilies to produce during the Christian year. Some of these books were produced by his own court scribes, others are the secondary copies, the next generation copies that now survive. Other books besides the Godskalk Evangelii and Dagald's Psalter were produced by the scribes and artists working for Charlemagne. Most of them that now survive are gospel books, partly because they're so grand that they were kept in safe places. But I'll show you just a few pictures of them. There are two groups of artists and scribes at the royal court, one of them producing a very painterly, realistic style, and the other a very formal style. And this is the Coronation Gospels, a text of a canon table page, just to show you that when you're writing for a king, you dye your parchment purple and write on it in gold. And the cost is unimaginable. Very, very expensive books indeed. But these Coronation Gospel books are the products of that first group. And then in the second, I've put another page from that gospel book with this very, very realistic style of an evangelist portrait to contrast with the very stylized version on the other side of the screen. And then you have another example of the painterly style Coronation Gospels on the left with this gold and jewel ornament guard, and then a text page from the same book. And then the Lorsch Gospels, produced again by the more stylized scribe, and that's the book that you will see. The Saint Denis Gospels, the Charlemagne Gospels, to show you how grand the text pages are. Then we have the other interests that are reflected in the surviving books. One of these is this Eusebius Chronicon, which starts out with the creation and then Abraham, and then puts everything out in color-coded columns of all the empires, and as empires rise and fall, so the columns disappear. And this is just one of the very early pages in it, and it's now in Latin. The Liber Pontificalis, the Book of the Popes, I don't think this was owned by Charlemagne, but it's the same period as his. So it's another instance of some of the books he had. And then there's patristic theology, canon law, Latin grammar, poetry, glossaries of all kinds of other books, including some that he actually had written for him at court. There is actually a list that survived. The photograph I had was too awful, so I didn't show it to you. It used to be thought to be Charlemagne's library, but I now think that actually it's probably more likely to be designated as a list of books that would have been used in teaching Latin literary composition, might be associated with a court, possibly Pippin of Italy, but not necessarily a list of books in a library as such. So, but what all these demonstrate to you is an enormous emphasis on preoccupations with the Christian faith and Latin simultaneously, with which I started this section. But let me now, to end with, return to Einhard. In his life, written shortly, as I've suggested, after the emperor's death, he records his burial in a palace chapel dedicated to Mary the Virgin at Aachen. And above his tomb, a gilded arch with an image and an inscription was erected. The inscription stated, as you see, that Charles the Great and Orthodox Emperor gloriously increased the kingdom of the Franks, reigned with great success, died in his 70s, 28th of January, in the year of our Lord, 814. Now, quite apart from the crucial designation of Charlemagne as Orthodox, and that he died in 814 of the Christian era, the resonance with the Roman past is most obvious with the provision of the inscription itself, recognizing both his imperial title and his achievements. In this, the Franks followed the custom of the Roman Senate's erection of monuments to celebrate their emperors, a custom that was deliberately emulated subsequently by many who hoped to bolster their political prestige with an appeal to imperial Roman precedent. I owe this next example to Derek Beals. In October 1721, the Senate in Russia declared new titles, Father of the Fatherland, Emperor of all Russia, for Peter the Great, as was the custom, they said, of the Roman Senate in recognition of their emperors. Famous deeds to pronounce such titles publicly as a gift and to inscribe them on statues for the memory of posterity. The imperial title and rank was a prize jealously guarded as well as aspired to. Russian claims to empire caused particular problems for relations between Catherine the Great and the Habsburg Emperor Joseph II in 1781. There's Joseph being crowned with the then thought to be imperial crown, but actually it's 10th century. Now, although Charlemagne's inscription has not survived, his supposed sarcophagus is a reused 3rd century monument of Carrara marble depicting the rape of Proserpina, and it's still on display to modern visitors to the palace chapel in Aachen. The sarcophagus itself was the object of further imperial pretensions on Napoleon's part, for it was looted by Napoleon Bonaparte and only returned to Aachen after the debacle of Waterloo in 1815. Napoleon's appropriation of so much that was Carolingian and early medieval in his ideology of empire, moreover, as well as the Habsburgs' pride, serve as eloquent witnesses to the role of Charlemagne and his empire in the development of imperial ideology generally, especially in the 18th and 19th centuries. And we get some sense of this by the statues erected around Europe in that period, and I end with a brief display of these. A reliquary from the 13th century, which some of Charlemagne has been put, it's in Aachen. Dürer's famous portrait of Charlemagne wearing the Reichs Krone, again an anachronism, it's 10th century, but Carolus Magnus, very proudly displayed. Statue outside Zurich, I can't remember where that is, it's Dieppe. Zurich again, that is definitely in Belgium, and finally outside the Church of Notre Dame.